The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Another day, another campaign says bye-bye. Rand Paul has suspended his campaign, reportedly for the White House. The big votes this week were cast in Iowa, and the numbers were just not definitive. Hillary edged out a victory that was narrow enough to be worrisome. Can Bernie Sanders keep his socialist balloon in the air? That's the question for him. Senator Ted Cruz won on the GOP side, but in the record turnout, a uniform dismissal of all those governors in the race has suddenly pushed third place Marco Rubio into the spotlight. Is Iowa a fresh start for the Florida senator? What will voters see if they are reintroduced to Marco Rubio? Well, we ask longtime Florida political hand Al Cardenas. He's a senior partner in the international law firm Squire Patton Boggs, former chairman of American Conservative Union, and former chairman of the Florida GOP. He says Iowa was like the old carnival days, he thought. For the top four candidates, everyone's a winner.
I've been following Iowa presidential elections for a long time. It's the first one that I've witnessed where four candidates gave a victory speech. And I've never seen that happen. But I think the media and the public at large took notice. I thought that Senator Rubio's campaign staff and the senator himself did a great job. I've known him all his adult life. He's a talented, perhaps the most talented candidate or politician in the Republican primary. Even exuding his youth, he shows talent and dominion of the facts, and he's intellectually curious. The big question mark's always been the fact that, like President Obama, he didn't really have managerial experience beforehand, and some people question that, but he's certainly a gifted orator and a gifted politician.
So people are going to see two things, that he's articulate, that he exudes confidence, but that he's a pretty young person, and there may be some questions about his experience. Is that fair?
I think so. One of these days in the Union Leader, there appeared a full-page ad signed by eight House speakers in Florida, Republican House speakers who knew both Governor Bush and then Representative and Speaker Rubio really well, and they all signed this ad supporting Governor Bush, just saying that they've known them both better than probably anyone else in the country, and just felt like Governor Bush was ready to manage the nation on day one and be commander-in-chief.
Now, Al Cardenas, are you arguing for a Bush-Rubio ticket or a Rubio-Bush ticket there?
Boy, I wish that could be the case, John. There's a quirk in our Constitution that says you can indeed be a ticket, but you forfeit your delegates to the convention. And unless it's a clear winner where it doesn't really matter, it's hard to give up all the delegates in Florida. That's the third state in number of delegates.
Okay, but that's a very clever dodge to the question. what do you think? Would Bush benefit from Marco Rubio's youth because charisma? Because, Jeb Bush hasn't done much in this campaign so far. And would Rubio benefit from a vice presidential running mate in Jeb Bush because of his experience?
Well, that's right. The one who ends up winning gets to make the choice, and they'll both see what works best. But this campaign could well go until the very end. There was a feeling amongst many that perhaps Donald Trump could run the table, and of course that what happened in Iowa dispelled that possibility, and it looks to me, based on what's going on, that at some point in time, probably after South Carolina, there's going to be a narrowing of this race to probably four candidates.
Although Trump, you know, decided not to play the ground game in Iowa, and right. even though he did just do his meetings and his, you know, kind of jet in and jet out approach, I mean, he came in second. I mean, he did really well to an amazing Ted Cruz ground game. So I wonder if that's a fair contest, if really we're only going to know about this run the table business in New Hampshire.
Well, I just think that he was ahead in Iowa for a significant period of time. There are other states, especially in the South, that are demographically very similar to Iowa. And those who felt he was running the table were those who saw the national polls, where he had a significant lead throughout the country, and looked at Iowa and said, you know, if he can win Iowa, that's going to be hard to stop, because Iowa, frankly, would be one of the most difficult states for him to win. Without a ground game, he did spectacularly well there. And in New Hampshire, he's up by 15, 20 points. That state more fits his demographic style. But he still should be considered the favorite. But I have a strong feeling that this race will tighten up rather than loosen up as the states hold their primaries.
But for the time being, there's two Cubans in the race.
Amazing, right?
Do you believe that, huh?
Boy, I tell you, as a Cuban American, I look at this and say, boy, who would have told me that? I came to this country as a refugee, thankful to have been given a welcome, and little did I know that that the next generation would be fielding two presidential candidates.
Al Cardenas is a senior partner in the international law firm of Squire Patton Boggs. He's former chairman of the American Conservative Union and former chairman of the Florida GOP. Thanks so much, Al.
My pleasure, John.
The candidates still in the race have all moved on to New Hampshire now, but these days when your campaign moves, so does the opposition. In another installment of our behind-the-scenes series, Road Warriors, Life on the Campaign Trail, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick takes a look at how campaigns keep constant tabs on each other.
In modern campaigning, a lens follows you wherever you go, so your opponents see and hear everything you say, everything you do. Kelly Farr has traveled all across America following politicians with a camera in hand. She's what's known in campaign culture as a tracker. Kelly's a Democratic political consultant today, but in 2008, she followed Republicans John McCain and Sarah Palin to nearly every state on the presidential campaign trail. And today, nearly every major political campaign in the country has trackers following them around. On the one hand, tracking means accountability, and on another, it means your words will be used against you in the court of public opinion.
A tracker is someone that follows anyone running for public office to make sure that they're held accountable for any words that they say while they're trying to gain votes.
Now, you say follows them how? With a camera, with a microphone, wherever they go? How does it work?
Any time that they are talking to constituents or possible voters, we want to record those moments. So that's following them around with a camera, it's following them around with a microphone. It's to make sure that people are held accountable for what they're saying. So they're not going to, you know, the Chamber of Commerce and saying one thing and then going to a teachers union and saying the exact opposite. It's to keep people true to their word, so they're not out there just pandering and saying whatever they can to gain votes.
A lot of people kind of get their start doing this, right? I mean, this is one of the feet in the door for a young person with an eye on politics.
Sure. It is a popular job to take right out of college if you're a political science or a government major. It's a good start to see kind of a different aspects of campaigning. You get to see the press point, obviously. You get to do a lot of research on your own.
All right. Now, I want to get down to sort of what tracking really is, because I think when people imagine what this can do, they sort of want to get the silver bullet. You want to get the thing that absolutely kills the opposition. I want to play you an example of when this actually happened, Kelly Farr. Listen to this.
This fellow here over here with the yellow shirt, Makaka, or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following us around everywhere. So welcome. Let's give a welcome to Makaka here.
Now, we were just listening there to former Senator George Allen at an event where he used a racist slur actually toward a tracker. And that moment, when it became a campaign commercial, pretty much meant that George Allen wasn't a senator anymore.
Yeah, most people go back to that moment of why he wasn't elected that cycle and let people, you know, all through the state see who he really was, show his real colors. Someone that doesn't think those thoughts doesn't just say things like that off the cuff.
But is most tracking like that? Is that the kind of thing you're getting, the silver bullet, the stake through the heart, or is it something different?
You know, unless you're tracking Sarah Palin or Donald Trump, you're usually not going to get those kind of moments. You're going to get very scripted speeches. So what is more likely to happen is if someone's lying about their voting record, if someone's just pandering a little center or a little right from what they usually say, or you'll get smaller off-the-cuff moments, you know, during rope lines or smaller town halls. But most electeds are a little smarter than to say things like that.
I got to think that you heard John McCain's stump speech 100 times. I may not even be exaggerating.
No, you're not exaggerating. You probably heard it more than that. Most trackers know someone's speech better than that candidate knows their speech. You know, they might be hearing it 6 times a day. So you know when someone veers off of what their campaign has written for them.
I have to imagine that the staff who works for the candidate that you're tracking must look upon you with quite a lot of disdain. I mean, they know why you're there. They get it. They're not going to help you out at all, right?
It really depends on the campaign. You know, I was a tracking director as well, so I had a lot of trackers on a lot of different races over years. And so we came into a contact with hundreds of different campaigns. And some were, you know, really respectful and realized that, you know, we were there to get a job done and we were very respectful back. Some candidates on the other side were pretty aggressive. Some campaigns were very aggressive. Some staffers, some volunteers assaulted different trackers of, you know, trying to push them outdoors, trying to push them down staircases, putting signs in front of their camera, playing music on an iPod in their camera microphone so they couldn't capture a moment, basically doing everything possible to make sure that you didn't get the shot.
All right. So, Kelly, we talked about sort of the realities of tracking, getting every utterance in case somebody distorts or lies about their record. But back to that silver bullet, what's the biggest get you ever got?
You know, my team was associated with a lot of them. I was at a Palin rally in Ohio where it wasn't necessarily the candidate. It was the people on the ground. It was her supporters getting pretty violent. We're getting pretty racist.
Obama, good morning!
Actually started attacking the press riser because they were blaming the media on Sarah Palin's kind of fall from grace. My team at American Bridge caught many moments from, you know, Josh Mandel attacking one of our trackers. One of our first hits was John Bruning compared welfare recipients to raccoons.
The raccoons, they're not stupid. They're going to do the easy way if we make it easy for them, just like welfare recipients all across America.
You know, Kelly, I hear the life that you're describing and the realities of tracking, and it makes sense in this day and age especially. But no regular person has to have a camera on them all the time. No regular person gets every single utterance checked against every other utterance. Do voters miss something, do you think, about the quality of the candidates they're asked to vote for or their records by this constant surveillance that we put them under now?
I mean, a regular person doesn't get to make daily decisions that affect millions of Americans. These people know what they're up against and know what they're asking for when they choose a public life. You know, we're not following people to the grocery store or on day-to-day things like that. These are events that they are trying to convince voters to vote for them. And so we are making sure that those voters have as much information as possible when they go into that voting booth.
Kelly Farr, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly Farr is a Democratic political consultant in Washington, D.C. She's also a veteran tracker at firms like American Bridge. She followed John McCain and Sarah Palin throughout the 2008 presidential campaign.
Isn't it great that suddenly with an actual delegate contest under our belts, there is something real to talk about in the presidential campaign for once? Bernie Sanders has a real momentum test coming up in New Hampshire. Number two in the Iowa caucuses, does he have to win New Hampshire big to show strength in his home-baked territory of New England and prevent the challenging Southern primaries from overwhelming his campaign and his straightforward message?
Today in America, we are the wealthiest nation in the history of the world. But few Americans know that because so much of the new income and wealth is going to the people on top.
That Sanders message was streamed to the world digitally last year from Georgetown University. This message was recorded originally on film and videotape back in 1983 when it was Mayor Bernie Sanders of Burlington, Vermont.
We are the heirs of a tradition of many, many hundreds of years before the word socialism was coined. The vision is not different today than it was hundreds of years ago. Egalitarianism, the right that all human beings are entitled to a decent life, the right that a handful of people shouldn't run the country or the world. Nothing new about this. They've been talking about it for a few thousand years. And that's what we're talking about today.
Whatever the images you're looking at, he's unafraid, he's unassuming, he's unaffected by celebrity and the trappings of the power bubble in any of his public life. You might say Bernie Sanders is the anti-Trump. Arun Chaudhary served as the first official White House videographer from 2009 to 2011. He's now creative director at Revolution Messaging and serves as the digital creative director for the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. And that means when you stumble on an internet image of the candidate, Arun makes sure that that image lets you see what he sees through the camera.
I think the one thing that you can only tell about a politician through filming them, something that is impossible to figure out at a debate or from a speech or an interview, is how intellectually curious is your candidate? What do they think about? Things they don't know about, and how do they approach that? Because there's so much stagecraft in politics, and the whole thing is set up, you know, oftentimes for television shows or for the media in general, that unscripted, honest moments in which an individual, a man or woman, may be sort of asking questions like, what is this? I'd like to know more about this. It's something I think is fundamentally unique to sort of backstage videography when it comes into politics, and is just an amazingly important tool for voters to get to know the people who are going to be their elected officials.
How many hours of video do you take on a, you know, busy day, say the Iowa caucuses?
You know, here's what it is, I think, when you're really effectively doing this work and being close to a candidate or being close to a government official, it's that you want to be around all the time, but you don't want to be shooting all the time. You want to be judicious about what you shoot, because if you're just shooting all the time, A, you have all this footage and no time to edit it, and B, you're just creating a haystack for yourself to find the good stuff in. So I think it's about being in a presence, especially when you're talking about politicians, they have bubbles. It's about traveling in that bubble, but only raising the camera up when you need it. And some of that is technical, and some of that is artistic, and some of that is also just personality-based. Nobody wants to hang out, you know, with the cameraman who has the camera in their face all the time. You know, I can actually give you, you know, an example of that. Just coming out of the Iowa caucuses, Bernie Sanders and his wife Jane decided to take a walk just to, you know, clear head, see what was going on, take stock, and they walked around the lake. And the reason that there are no pictures of it is because I did not chase after him with the camera. I was like, I think this is actually a private moment, and he would like to go do that.
What on Bernie Sanders' face tells you he's about to do something that you're going to want to shoot?
Bernie Sanders and Barack Obama, you know, who I've gotten a chance to work very close with both of them, are very similar in that they are just the same person on and off camera. That being said, it means he's sort of always doing something that's camera worthy because he's always being Bernie Sanders. But I like try to look at it through his head. So is what he is doing or talking about or interacting adding up to something that's on message, for lack of a better word, that actually promotes an idea? But if it's just sort of access to get it, then I know that he's probably not going to be as much into it because he's just someone who is very practical, is very passionate, and doesn't want to commit resources or energy to something that is not going to, you know, help further whatever his aim is, whether it be, you know, legislation or getting the vote out or whatever the actual task at hand is.
But in looking at some of the poll numbers, aren't some of the challenges that you're filming the age of who Bernie is talking to?
You know, it's funny when you're talking about looking at things through the lens, because obviously the Bernie Sanders phenomenon has really taken a hold with young people in an amazing way, and it's been very gratifying to watch them and to take those photographs, which is primarily what I've been doing these last weeks. But you could see through the lens, you could see in the pictures, the nature of the crowd, you know, being very, very young and the people being very, very excited. And I think that is not something people immediately thought of when they thought of the Bernie Sanders campaign. I think they thought it might be a lot of older folks who maybe, you know, were of his generation and wanted to have the conversation about FDR and things like that. But it turns out that he is most exciting for young people who are really looking for more. And it's just the undeniable proof that it was true was just through the lens. Picture after picture was just excited young person on the rope line, just rushing up to meet this man.
this curious phenomenon in filmmaking where you get the illusion that because you're holding the camera, you see everything that nobody else sees. But sometimes when you get in the edit room, you realize, oh my God, I had no idea what I was looking at. Characters sort of step out of the viewfinder and become these huge characters.
Like all great artistic inventions, and perhaps I'm overstating, I'm saying all great, this was born out of necessity. Once Bill Clinton did so well in the New Hampshire primary, if you were a documentary filmmaker, you knew you were never going to see him again because now he was a serious candidate and the upswing for whatever you were doing was going to be way worse than the downswing, whatever they were going to get. And so the idea of kind of shifting the focus of the movie downstream to the consultants, I think now seems so obvious. Like, of course you just do that. But no one had really thought of that before. And I think we have now an entire sort of genre, both of work that's done in the service of campaigns, work that's done in documentary, and frankly, work that's done in fiction film that is entirely based on that idea. So when you think about someone like a David Axelrod, who's like a character in the Barack Obama story, you know, when you think of a show like The West Wing, the idea that, you know, the president's not going to be in every shot, but all the folks who work for him are actually going to be in every shot. All of that, I think, goes out to people very practically looking at the bubble, looking at politics from a news or from a documentary perspective. And then in this case, just born of necessity, being like, we no longer have access to the candidate. How else can we tell this story? But I'm just so grateful for that because so much of the work that I've done is really standing on the shoulders of those giants who figured some of those things out. And if I had one thing to add to sort of the canon, I think the thing that I brought to it, my idea, was always that true, authentic political art should always take something that's extraordinary and make it ordinary so that regular folks can understand what this is. Am I giving someone an authentic experience? Am I answering a real question that they've asked? Am I giving information that is practically useful in their lives? And I think when you do those things and when you navigate this world, which can seem tricky and, you know, and devious and all of these things, with that kind of simple, open-hearted manner, you can make great, great things, whether that be the race speech that Barack Obama gave in 2008 or something as simple as Bernie Sanders' 404 message, which is the message that you get when you type something incorrectly on the internet.
The good news is you're on the right website, and it's a really good website. The bad news is you're on the wrong page. Just scoot down to the bottom of the page, and you'll find your way back home to where you should be.
These things can be funny, they can be tragic, they can be heartfelt, but they have to be real.
Arun, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Arun Chaudhry served as the first official White House videographer from 2009 to 2011. He's now creative director at Revolution Messaging and digital creative director for the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. What are we to make of the Zika virus? Is it a faraway crisis transmitted by foreign mosquitoes attacking only pregnant mothers? The World Health Organization says that Zika is an international public health emergency. A vaccine is being rushed to trials, according to WHO Director Anthony Costello.
Even if we got lucky and found a biologically vulnerable part of this virus to get a vaccine, the procedures would take, I think, at the minimum, we're talking about years, not months.
The French drug maker Sanofi is reportedly on the case, and the U.S. government is also starting research into a possible vaccine. But in the time that that takes, a lot could happen. Zika could find additional hosts to speed its transmission. A documented case of Zika was transmitted sexually, according to doctors in Dallas. Dr. Anthony Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Doctor, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
So it seems that we don't know a whole lot about this class of viruses. What is unusual about Zika?
Well, the thing that's unusual about Zika right now is that it had originally been felt to be somewhat of an inconsequential virus that was first recognized in 1947 in Uganda and kind of hung around below the radar screen in Africa and Southeast Asia, not really paying much attention to it because it's a mild disease. And then all of a sudden, as it worked its way across the Pacific Islands from Yap to South America, it exploded. So now you have this major outbreak, which would have been bad enough. But the thing that's now really puzzling is the apparent temporal and geographic association with infection in a mother and a severe congenital abnormality in the fetus of the pregnant woman. And that's the thing that's very disturbing right now. So there are a lot of unknowns about what that connection is, what the degree of the connection is. So we have a lot to learn, and we're trying to do that very quickly.
So there's a lot of statistical association between the virus and microcephaly, the small head birth defect. But there's no causation. There's no clear understanding of how that works.
Exactly. There is not a definitive cause-effect relationship, although the circumstantial evidence is really rather compelling. We have to be careful before we say that this particular virus directly is causing the birth defects that we see, even though the association is really very strong.
Let's talk about vaccine for a moment. What would be the target population for a vaccine? All of childbearing age mothers, all people sexually active, the entire population? I mean, I don't know what the preventive measure would be here, because the symptoms aren't necessarily presented to a doctor or even in a family.
Well, you know, all good points that you make, but I really feel I must point out when you said what is the best approach. Right now, I mean, we are trying very hard for a vaccine and we're working very, very intensively. But the way to stop this outbreak is to stop the mosquito. Obviously, we want a vaccine, and particularly when you're dealing with a situation where you're concerned about pregnant women, one of the target populations almost certainly will be women of childbearing age.
Meanwhile, while we wait, there's the fear of this virus jumping. I mean, in two ways. It could jump from the mosquito that you mentioned that's prevalent in South America to other species of mosquitoes that would carry it into North America and throughout the world. And then it could also acquire a vector of sexual transmission, which has already been seen. What disturbs you about all that?
Well, it expands the scope of this of the range, actually, of involvement, because we know now that there are at least a couple of cases of well-documented sexual transmission. And that's the reason why there will be CDC guidelines coming out soon, which, as you would expect, is encouraging the use of condoms for people who are in the area, even whether they got sick or not. But if you go into an area where it's highly prevalent to have a Zika infection, it's important to realize that one of the risks is transmission through sexual contact. And this would be particularly problematic if you're having sexual contact with a person like your wife who might be in the early stages of her pregnancy, and you really want to avoid that. That's the reason why you're going to be hearing about recommendations, strong recommendations about condom use for people at risk.
World Health Organization calls this an emergency, an international public health emergency. Is that an alarm that goes off in doctors' offices, or should that alarm be going off in my kitchen?
It's the kind of alarm that really is the clarion call that we now really need to pay serious attention to this. As far as the things that we do here in the United States, the kind of preparations that we are making and will make, are not really profoundly influenced by that kind of a declaration. It is more a global clarion call that we really need to put all hands on deck to address this at a multinational level. But we already in the United States are already in the process of gearing up to try and accelerate our efforts.
I saw what looked like a responsible headline that suggested that as the temperature rises, Zika seems to love an increase in global temperatures.
Well, whenever you can get flourishing of mosquitoes, and you obviously see that to some extent, if not to a big extent, during summer months, that the mosquitoes tend to flourish, as we all know who are bitten by mosquitoes, that's one of the things you're concerned about, that if you have a disease that is a mosquito-borne infection, you have a particular problem during a time of the year when there are a lot of mosquitoes around. So that's the real concern about the season change.
Would you cancel the Olympics?
Well, it's not up to me to cancel the Olympics, but I don't think we're at that point at all right now. I think the important thing to do, and this would impact not only the countries apart from the Olympics, but certainly would have an impact on the Olympics, is to have a very aggressive mosquito control program. Elimination of mosquitoes by larvicides, insecticides, but even as important, and that is the removal of the kinds of environment that mosquitoes like standing water in pots, pans, tires, in little pools of water that make it perfect for mosquitoes to flourish and breed. And there is already a very aggressive, concerted effort on the part of the Brazilian authorities to address that. So get to the mosquitoes and you won't have to worry about the other things.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Today, the House of Representatives holds its first hearing on the Flint water crisis, but former Flint emergency manager Darnell Early has refused to testify.
We're calling on the U.S. Marshals to hunt him down, give him that subpoena. Today, we're issuing a new subpoena. He will appear, and he will be here to do a deposition later this month.
A seriously stressed Utah Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz. In Flint, the efforts to address the water contamination crisis may have created another kind of health crisis, the stress of uncertainty about the water, the future, and the unknown health implications of some families having used largely unfiltered water for as long as 18 months. It's a mental health crisis all its own. Vicki Johnson Lawrence is an assistant professor of public health and health sciences at the University of Michigan, Flint, where she specializes in social epidemiology and biostatistics. She says the psychological damage in Flint can't be measured in micrograms or parts per million. It's in the faces of people and hangs like fog above everyone's kitchen table.
I think we're going to see significant long-term indications of psychological distress, and I think major continued stressors. The issues in Flint are not, even though the water issues have been relatively new, the social and economic structure and, quite frankly, deterioration of Flint is not new and happened along with deindustrialization a couple of decades ago. We have health needs in this community. There are concerns around mental health access, and I would argue that those concerns are for people of all ages, not just children or adults or elderly. It's everyone. And this trauma, this experience, has created a level of psychological distress that can only be, this has been a catastrophe. And that phrase has been used by community residents, and I certainly won't say it was something I coined. This catastrophe for Flint residents means that they will need long-term social supports in order to help them deal with the distrust that is developed between community residents and the institutions in the city. They will need supports to help their families grow and develop in a quote-unquote normal way. And by that, I mean we need to make sure parents have resources to parent their children, particularly if we think there's going to be an increased risk of cognitive impairment among those children. This stressor could lead or could be a precursor to major mental and mental health illnesses. So if that's going to be a potential outcome, we need to make sure that parents have resources for themselves to take care of their mental health. And lastly, if we're going to be very realistic about this, we have an elderly population that will continue to need care, and it will only become more intense as this issue unfolds. And this issue can't be forgotten.
I can tell that you're someone who has a sensitive understanding of the fragility of the Flint community.
Yes.
And I can hear as you, you know, grope for words to describe this, that you're pretty deeply feeling this catastrophe.
I am. I have a lot of friends, close friends now. I live a lot of my life within the city limits. And my children go to school in the city. I work in the city. And when I think about what this could mean long term for not only my family, but those around me, and particularly those around me who may not have the same resources I do, it's our responsibility, it's our public health responsibility to advocate and make sure that those who need resources get them. There's a lot of work to be done, and there's a long way to go to bring this community around to a better place than where it was before this event, and I'm determined to do that through my public health work, but also through my community relationships, partnerships, and friendships.
Vicki Johnson Lawrence is assistant professor of public health and health sciences at the University of Michigan, Flint. She specializes in biostatistics and epidemiology, and she also specializes in knowing her neighbors. Vicki, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Happy talk, keep talking, happy talk.
Here's one more thing to take with you, and yet another example of how when you've got big data, there's no way to resist peering into it. An analysis by an analytics firm with the spooky name Marchex took more than 4 million private consumer conversations and constructed a ranking of people's speech state by state in the U.S., from speediest to slowest and from densest to most sparse talkers, people who use few words, lots of spaces, you know. Speediest talkers from Oregon. Although if you took out the use of the word like, that ranking might, like, slip. Next speediest is Minnesota, then Massachusetts, slowest Mississippi. But densest, most word talkers, number one, New York, number 50, Oklahoma. And there's nothing more to say about that without offending someone, so I'll just say, give us your take at 8778MYTAKE, send us a tweet, at The Takeaway, and find the amazing Takeaway podcast on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Talk about a boy saying to a girl, golly, baby, I'm a love.
PRI, Public Radio International.